am so excited to be joined by Cindy from Results Lab, and we are going to ask a question in this conversation that I think many of us forget to ask. But before we get there, Cindy, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks, Alexandra. Appreciate you having me. We've had some previous conversations that were kind of fun, so good to continue. I'm Cindy Eby. I'm the founder and CEO of Results Lab. And at Results Lab, we work with social sector organizations, primarily nonprofits, philanthropic foundations, and some government organizations on how they can deepen their impact using data. So we're really focused on good data use, but also good program design. And how do you think about what your impact is, what you're trying to achieve with those that you're serving, how you're going to do that, and then how you capture data on both of those things, what your results are and how you're getting there to inform continuous improvement, to inform your journey with those that you're serving, and really focus on actionable data use. So we have a cycle we've developed, Align, Capture, Transform, that walks organizations through that and helps them do that to ensure we're getting to that data use phase. Quick sort of summary of what we do.
I know, and seeking that elusive, you know, true actionable data utilization. So excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And, you know, you talked a lot about being, or at a high level about figuring out how do your programs work? Are they working the right way? And how do we use data to improve on that? And so I think a lot of organizations are very aware of their gaps in knowledge around evaluation, right? They may not have a full-time evaluator. And so they like to ask questions about how do we evaluate our programs? And when we connected, we landed on a question that happens before that, which is, how do you know if you are ready for evaluation? And are you even ready for evaluation? So I'd like to back up to that part and say, what do you start with before you even try to design evaluation? What do you need to have in place?
Yeah, it's a very good, very important question. And a lot of organizations in my experience in my career, and then at Results Lab, a lot of organizations come to us and say, we want to do an evaluation, or what data should we collect? And we can't answer that question unless we know what it is you're trying to do and who you're trying to serve and how you're doing that. And so readiness for evaluation, really a major precursor for that is what is a really well-defined program and well-defined outcomes. So like I said, with our ACT cycle, it's important to think about who you're serving and what you're trying to accomplish with them and create a program that addresses that. And you know, lots of organizations have the programs they operate, but when you start to dig into what is it that you're doing for the people that you're serving, there's some fuzziness in there. Mm-hmm. And really diving a bit more deeply into the design of the program, and would highly, highly advocate for input from the people that you're serving. What is it that they need? Getting some feedback from them on where they're trying to get to, what services are most helpful is a really important step in that process. But program design is really important. So diving pretty deeply into that, defining who you're serving, what the outcomes are, how you're going to get there with some like really picky detail. So how long do they need to be in your program? How frequently do they need the service that you provide? What is happening in that program? Like, what's the content? And we would call that your program model, and everything I just described is sort of the dosage of the programming. People don't really like to think of it that way. It sounds a little medicalized, which we don't want to do, but like theoretically, based on your experience, based on research that's out there, based on what your current client population says, what theoretically do you believe needs to happen to bring about the outcomes that you want to see? And defining that really well, because then when you have the data, you can test against that. So I think that's a big, the design and inclusively designed, informed by research is an important step.
That's a great, I like the term dosage, in that it gets to the point that if you're trying to say, does Advil help headaches? Right. You need to say, well, like, how much Advil are you taking? Right. When are you taking it? And no one would think to try to decide if Advil helped without setting those things. But right. We often, when we're trying to think about social interventions, we're very quick to skip that part of like, oh, well, we did things and that's what matters. Like we did programs, we had people show up, we, you know, there was activity. Right. And yet, like you said, that fuzziness, that lack of specificity around the activity makes it basically impossible to use data in any meaningful way.
Yeah, completely. And yeah, to use your Advil analogy, like if you're depressed, Advil is probably not going to help you. Like, or, you know, if you have a headache, is a partial Advil going to help you? Maybe not, you know. So knowing what the problem is, so mm-hmm. what the challenge is, mm-hmm. and getting a lot of input. I think program staff and nonprofits have great expertise. They have a lot of thoughts about their experience in running the program. What is, we call this an impact strategy, by the way, an impact strategy and program model. But what do we think is really needed? What do our clients say is really needed? What does research say is really needed?
I like that triangulation, that idea of what does the research say? What do our clients say? What does our experienced team say?
Yeah.
Right. That you're using all three of those to try to triangulate towards your best guess. Right. And it's okay if it's a guess, right? Like that's the point right. of using the data to then test that and exactly. say, is our guess going in the right direction or do we need to course correct?
100%, because often, like, maybe someone looked at research at some point, but sometimes not. And in some ways, program staff will loop in the perspective of program participants, but really directly asking is important. That's often left out. Like if you think about human-centered design, your design's going to be faulty if you're not hearing from the humans that are going to benefit from what you do. And like, to your point, continuous, like to improve, it's fine. It's your theory. It's your idea of what works well. You're going to work to improve it. That's any organization out there should be doing this continuously. Like what's mm-hmm. working, what's not working, how do we improve it? And that's kind of quality improvement set of work mm-hmm. that also, it depends what you call evaluation. I would say quality improvement also comes before evaluation. So if we're going to say evaluation is a one-time event where someone comes in and looks at how the program is doing and what the outcomes are they're achieving. Is it being implemented well? If evaluation is just doing that once, which often it is, mm-hmm. Then you need to be doing some continuous improvement before you do a more rigorous evaluation. Mm-hmm. We can go down this tangent or not. There's something called an evidence continuum where it's five stages. It's have your impact strategy or theory of change is stage one. It's everything we just talked about based on expertise, based on research, based on client input. What's your theory about what's needed and what will work? Stage two is we start to look at implementation. Are we doing it well? Are we delivering what we thought we'd deliver? If someone needed six coaching sessions in 6 months, are they actually getting it? And then start to look at short-term outcomes in step three. If you're not implementing well, there's no reason to look at outcomes. So look at if you're implementing well. Step three is look at outcomes, pre-post a little bit. Steps four and five are more rigorous, what I would call evaluation. So quasi-experimental designs in step four, randomized control trials, so experimental designs in step five. So if we're calling steps four and five evaluation, there's a lot to do before that. Capturing data, using it for improvement. Are we implementing well? If not, why? You know, doing those feedback loops and root cause analysis about if someone's not getting coaching sessions, why is that? Could be something as simple as they can't make that time. We need to change our time. It could be something as complex as your content is wrong and it's not helping people, so they're not coming. In which case, that's a bigger change. So using data to implement well, to achieve outcomes well, and then a more rigorous study design is more appropriate, I would say.
I think these phases are a fantastic way of wrapping our heads around, like you said, a whole continuum of trying to get the thing we want to happen. And, you know, I think it makes sense to a lot of us that idea of the theory of change, that's very central in a lot of nonprofit practices. But the idea that then what comes out of that is that you should design something that you implement consistently. And right. I think that we do want to jump to, well, how do we know if what we're doing is working, right? We want to make sure we're doing the right thing. So we want to go straight to measuring it. And to your point, you're saying, well, no, you got to get it. You got to get the behavior consistent or the activities consistent, because otherwise, what are you measuring? We mentioned that earlier. You mentioned a little bit in step two about root cause analysis. And I'm curious, you know, what role does data play in steps one and two before we even get to the evaluation part?
Yeah. I mean, in step one in design, it's looking at what already exists out there. Mm-hmm. What has been proven, I'm air quoting proven, mm-hmm. because there's also would be a whole side conversation around what's evidence. So there's what's proven. I also think why I say that triangle of program mm-hmm. folks, research, and your participants, those are all forms of evidence in my mm-hmm. opinion. So those are elements of data you need to hear from your people that you're serving, because that's data and they know what's best for their lives. So that's data in mm-hmm. stage one. Step two is when we start to look at, we've defined what the dosage is, we start to capture data on are we delivering that program? Mm-hmm. So is anyone in your program getting the dosage that you think they're going to need? And we would call that fidelity to the model. Fidelity also, this is where I think people get tripped up here, is people can resist the idea that an exact dosage is right for everyone. Mm-hmm. And an exact dosage is not right for everyone. But you have a theory about what's going to work. It's okay to flex. You might find while you're looking at data and delivery and then later outcomes, for certain folks in your program, more of something might work better or less of something might work better. So there might be variation within that. It's not rigid, mm-hmm. but it's intentional. It's the guide to say, here's what we think is needed, get the outcome that we're looking for, with some flex around that, because humans are humans. Mm-hmm. Humans, someone used an analogy with me once that humans are not hamburgers. you can't go on the line at McDonald's and put the patty right. down and put a slab of beef and put onions and some sauce and then you're done. Got a right. little, we're not widgets. So yes, variation within your mm-hmm. model, your dosage, variation and fidelity is just fine, but it's that unintentional variation that we want to avoid.
I really resonated with me that idea of not rigid but intentional. So you're right. not making willy-nilly off the cuff variation. Right. You're saying if we think Advil works, then everyone needs to get Advil. Right. We can't be giving some people gummy bears and some people, you know, head scalp massages, because now we're not actually working on the same thing. If we have a theory that Advil is going to help the headache and we've defined the headache.
Right. Everyone should probably have scalp massages always. Like that should always be a thing.
And so to your point, though, that you could maybe even have somewhat of a plan around your variation of what things exactly. do we think should be consistent? Like everyone should get at least one coaching session, sort of regardless. Everyone should have one. Now, whether they have one or four, we're going to give you some flexibility. But maybe that's also a data point that you collect, which is who got one, who got two, who got three. And you can use that to inform your theory of change to say, like, do certain people respond better to certain numbers of coaching sessions, et cetera. But you want to have that intentional set of variation so that you are testing an intervention.
Yeah, I mean, we'd encourage some consistency first around mm-hmm. what we think X is going to work. So try X.
Yes.
And then see, like, is it hard to deliver? Can you deliver it? Mm-hmm. How's it working? Like, is it feeling okay, like, to people? Mm-hmm. And then are you seeing outcomes?
Yeah.
Like, you can have, like maybe back to our headache example, maybe brain surgery is a great way to relieve a headache. I don't know. But that's not going to work for your people receiving the program. So you need an element of both quality and, like, is it working? Is it acceptable? Is it, are people okay with your program? Mm-hmm. Customer satisfaction is another way to say that.
Right.
But then, yes, like, then when you're looking at outcomes, is it working for some and not others? Mm-hmm. How do you slice and dice your data? So you were asking, how do you use data in the different phases? And that next phase of looking at outcomes, is it working for some and not others? And then if so, root cause, like, why? That's probably requires you going, talking to your program participants again. Like, what's happening there? Like, quantitative data tells us a what? Ooh, what are we seeing? We're seeing a variation that we don't understand, but it's the qualitative talking to people that helps you understand why. And so both pieces are needed there in both phases, I would say.
And you can also do that sort of quantitative qualitative feedback loop where you see a pattern, you see some variation, you do qualitative work to identify potential whys, get perspective, context, everything. And then you can try an intervention based on that contextual information that you got from your qualitative and use your quantitative to say, well, did we get it? You know, or do we need to go back and refine this more?
Right. What the audience won't be able to see when they listen to this podcast is Alexander was just making a circle with her hand. Exactly. Like, you capture the data, you look at it, you have some qualitative data to understand why, you make a change, and then you do that all again. So,
right. And you make an intentional change.
Intentional change.
An intentional change that is hopefully consistently then implemented across your programming. Everyone agrees on the change and they all put it in place and they see what happens.
Yes.
I wanted to go back to something that you said about your solution not working for everyone, because I think this is a place that when we get evidence and we're testing an idea, especially like in phases 1, 2, and 3, we can get really stuck. You know, I heard this around alternative charter schools, and there was a group of new charter schools that were testing a model, a very specific model, and we're tracking, they were sort of at to phase 3. They said, here's a problem we've defined. We want to work with students to be able to achieve these educational outcomes. We think that this model of intervention in a school will be effective at doing that. And they implemented it and then measured kids' scores and attention and executive function to see if it was working. Mm-hmm. And what people started pushing back with was like, well, but it doesn't work for this student or like this kind of student. So therefore your intervention doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how we navigate that fact of like you said, we need to put a consistent enough intervention to have something to measure. But to your point, it may not work for, even if we are narrowly defining our target population, there may be people, like you said, if you have a brain tumor, Advil's not going to help. You need brain surgery. Right? So how do we put that in as part of our process in handling that when we're testing interventions?
Yeah, there's a lot in there. So I think there's some real questions of like, who was it not working for? Mm-hmm. And who designed it and how was it designed? Mm-hmm. From an inclusive data practice and inclusive design standpoint. Since I don't know that specific context, it's kind of hard to answer that question. But some things that come to mind for me are like if you look at data objectively and seeing, like, I don't know how it was defined that it's not working for certain students. Maybe they weren't getting the educational progress that was anticipated. well, then something's clearly wrong. Something clearly isn't working for that group. And so I would say it's then that's what you just described before. Like what it's important to think about population. Often that's called target population. We really need a better word than that because that
sounds like you're taking aim
at all. The population that you're focused on, there may be subgroups where elements of your education process aren't working for them. So you need to understand why. So it's doing that cycle and understanding why it might be working for some and not others. The other thing that comes to mind with that scenario you put forward is when we think about asking questions about what works and what doesn't, when we see it's the program's working for some and not others, it's important to think about the question that we're asking. So we're phrasing it, why is the program not working for these students? You could phrase it as, why is the school not delivering a program that works for these students? Like, what is it that the school needs to change to deliver well for these students? And so just shifting it a little bit to say, what is not happening that might need to happen to see that what is the school not doing? What is the charter school not doing that they might need to? It just shifts it a little bit rather than saying, well, there must be something with that group.
Right.
But it might not be something with the group. It's something with the program or the approach.
That's a really interesting point that even just how we ask the question from a linguistic point of view will ultimately impact the data that we think we need and the approach that we take to answering it. So I think that's a really important point that we need to think, while it might feel like nitpicking about semantics, it's actually deeply, deeply meaningful of what does that reveal around our assumptions of where the cause lies and where the potential solutions lie. Because to your point, if we say, why does this program not work with certain students, that may lead us then, like we may sort of, like you said, have an underlying assumption that it has something to do with those students, whereas it may be nothing that's under the student's control. It has to do, like you said, with the delivery of the program.
Right.
Now, one thing though that I was also thinking, and this, I was pulling this example from several years ago, so I don't remember all of the details, but I was also thinking about it from the point of view of like my two kids who are wildly different from each other. And I can almost guarantee that even if you implemented a program with incredibly high fidelity that was very functional for my son, it might not work for my daughter just because of the difference in how, and if we say work, you know, I loved what you said about define what we mean by work and does not work. But like, if we're looking at like my son trying to learn all of the things that are grade appropriate, learn emotional control, you know, he's in elementary school, you know, and develop certain like math and literacy skills, you know, that you could end up with groups that sort of have mutually exclusive needs. Even though if we're generally talking about, you know, elementary school students within the same like intelligence range, I mean, from the same family even, right? Like we're talking about a pretty tight knit group that we could get very specific in defining, yet you still might end up where, even if, like you said, if the school were to adjust and try to provide something for one of them, that maybe it wouldn't work for the other. And so I'm curious about that. And maybe to your point, it's still possible to meet both of their needs. I don't know. That's where it came from, a kind of curious point here of measuring and defining what works and how we track that.
Yeah. I mean, not being an education expert.
that's true. I got stuck on that example. Sorry.
Waters for me. Because I'm sure educators think about this all the time. But if we're using it as an example.
Yes, theoretical example. We're not trying to actually solve the education system.
I think there's something about understanding the need of the individual that you're seeking to see change in.
Yes.
And that's what any program should be, is what and that might, and then what, how in bringing about that change or supporting them to make that change, be it learning or some other behavior change, what is going to help them? And that's going to look different for different, if we're trying to stay with like groups for different groups. And so knowing both, just knowing more about the population you're serving and hearing from them, I think can get you really far. It's back to the human-centered design idea.
Human-centered design. Granted,
like your daughter may not be able to articulate what is working for her, but I bet a well-experienced educator can ask questions about what would work for her. And same with an experienced program person. They'd be able to ask some questions about, well, if we're doing this and that doesn't seem to be working, let's get some input from our participants. Maybe we could do something different. So it's using your expertise to ask the right questions. And that's the other thing when we think about data interpretation and data use is it's all contextual. It's contextual based on who the data is coming from, who you're serving. It's based, like, you need to bring your experience to the table to interpret what you're seeing because we all bring different baggages to sense making of data. So program staff need to bring their expertise. That's why you also need to hear from your program participants to understand the meaning behind the data that you're seeing. Is they'll probably bring I bet you, if you pull in the perspective of your clients, they're going to share something with you that is new for you. So I kind of went off on a tangent.
What I think is so cool is I was, again, challenging assumptions. I was defining a population based on characteristics of that population, like where they come from, their family background. Like I was sort of in my mind making groups of people by age, et cetera, et cetera. But you turned that around in a way that I think is critical, which is really we should define the groups we want to serve by the particular need and maybe barrier. Right? Because your intervention by definition is going to be addressing that need and overcoming that barrier. And right. So you want, I'm going to put air quotes around the word homogenous, right? Like you want your group to be fairly similar in terms of the definition of it around that need and barrier question. Because if, to mix our metaphor is going back to our headache problem, right? You don't want to mix the brain tumor population with the headache population because they do require different interventions and you're just going to let one of them down. But if we're focused on the headache group, right, then we're going to be much better set up for success in creating a program that can be delivered consistently and see consistent results. So that I think already turned around and challenged like the assumptions I was making right around how we're going to define these populations. And I think that, again, the expertise comes into that, right? Having people themselves tell us what their needs and barriers are, having the expertise of your program administrators, you know, to the point of elementary school students might tell us some things, but the educators are going to be able to tell us a lot more in other areas. And then looking at the data and the research around identifying those particular needs and barriers, and then having your program build that theory of change to address that need and barrier, and then seeing, did we do it?
Yeah. Yes to all that. And it sounds like a lot, right? But people naturally do this in their daily work anyway. You're constantly asking a question and then seeking an answer. So let's slide some data into that. to formulate the question and to answer the question.
And I think you could almost simplify some things in that regard, because if we could get it down to, you know, a singular need and barrier, those feel more solvable.
Right.
Than trying.
Yeah, I think that's important because you can't do it all. I do think, you know, some ethics come up in this process, like, we see our program works for folks with headaches, but not folks with brain tumors. This is a terrible example.
I know, sorry. I went the right about that took a dark turn. I didn't mean to.
And so we know it only works for headache folks, so we're not going to serve folks with brain tumors. What is then the responsibility of the program? Is it to develop a new program for the brain tumor folks or to find a partner that does that? And so I think that might be this is something people grapple with when there's a suggestion that you may not be able to serve everyone. Mm-hmm. So thinking about that, and again, yeah, intentionally, and how you might help that those folks with other needs is something to consider, that you might be part of your program might be referrals or mm-hmm. something different.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting that when we talk about ethics, you know, again and again, people have sort of a pushback around data being somewhat heartless or cold, or, you know, that it is dehumanizes, right? I'm not just a data point. But when we think about that ethical responsibility, you may not even be aware of that need without the data that helps you understand you're serving one part of your population, but not another.
Yeah, exactly. And then is it really ethical to serve someone in your program when it's not going to help them?
Right.
And then that, you know, those resources could have gone to someone else.
Yep. Yeah. Or like you said, you could refer them to somebody who would be more likely to mm-hmm. be able to help them. So it's almost that we have a responsibility, a deep responsibility, to understand very well who our programs work for.
Yeah. Yes, we do.
So
data can help.
And data can help. Exactly. Data can help. So if we've got a small nonprofit listening to this, who's nodding along and going, yes, okay, I get this. I need to go through all of my phases. I need to understand, you know, how to achieve each of these different steps along the evidence continuum. I need to be making sure that I've got, you know, my programs in place, that I've defined my populations and my outcomes. What would be your recommendation of like the first step, that first thing we can do that is going to bring about some like meaningful change? They're going to see some results from taking that step forward in this space.
Yeah. I mean, I would go small with data. I'm a strong advocate for less is more. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of, you know, people start capturing certain data because it was required by a grant, and they just keep using it and they don't know why. They just keep capturing it. They're not using it. They just keep collecting it. They don't know why. Like when you ask, why are you collecting this? People are like, I don't know. We've always collected it. That's a resource drain. So I would say stay small and ask a specific question, like, what is challenging you right now around your programming? And then capture some data on that. You don't have to capture data on everything, because you won't be able to process that. So I think, you know, ask a targeted question. You know, maybe it's, you know, you have a couple, you have coaching and you have trainings. Maybe it's just getting, we see, like, from observing our program staff or observing that people aren't showing up to this training. Capture some information on why. And is it true? Like, who's attending the training and who isn't? That's some quantitative data. And then understand, capture the why. So just small, like, build small data muscle is, I think, a good focus. Don't boil the ocean.
I love that you added that people aren't showing up to our training. And it's like, okay, hang on. Are they? Like, let's actually ask the question of how many people are showing up at our training. Because I think that's a really easy one to miss, of just like, assume you know what the problem is. You know what the question should be. And then you try to answer it without realizing that your starting question, you didn't actually test that.
Right.
So that's a great point, which is test a question. If it is a real problem, then ask why. I think that's a great framework.
Well, and in that question too, you could be asking quantitatively, mm-hmm. who's attending and who isn't. Mm-hmm. So there might be a difference. There might not be.
Yep.
The data will tell you.
Exactly. I love this. Well, thank you so much for your time today. If folks want to learn more about you, about Results Lab, where could they go?
Our website is www.resultslab.com. I think you'll have that in the show notes. We'll have some other materials links in the show notes. But on our website, we've got a button that says, let's chat. you can reach out to anyone on our team. But that's a quick way to do it, is go to the website, hit the let's chat, and you'll get connected with somebody.
And excellent.
We're always ready to chat with folks.
Got this. Excellent. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Alexandra. Appreciate it.